Radio Netherlands, the home of high frequency since 1927.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave and satellite, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, a weekly survey of international communication developments. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and this week we're not in the regular Radio Netherlands studio, but we've come about 20 minutes' drive from Hilversum to a peaceful little town called Nederhorstenberg. There's very little in the way of industry here, a few shops and a gasoline station, but on the outskirts a whole array of different types of antennas, including a large satellite dish. For this is the headquarters of the Dutch PTT's monitoring station. We last brought the programme here some 5 years ago. It certainly changed quite a bit from what I can remember. New receivers have been installed, computers upgraded, and faces have changed too. Today we'll be dealing with two aspects of their work, namely monitoring what's on the radio. And to start with, I've come up to the Interference Division, where a small specialist group investigates complaints from the public and industry when one piece of equipment interferes with another. The current term for this field is EMC, which means electromagnetic compatibility. And if you've ever tried to listen to a shortwave radio within about 2 meters of a coloured television set, even if the TV is in the next room, this kind of interference must be all too familiar. Enough of that. Most interference complaints in the Netherlands, though, are the result of noises picked up off the air. Stripes on a TV screen due to passing motorbikes buzzing on the radio because of a nearby faulty thermostat. Very little noise finds its way into a radio receiver through the wiring in the household current supply here. In this densely populated part of Europe, most of the high-voltage power cables are buried underground. And in fact, this interference department at Nederhorstenberg is constantly measuring the amount of unwanted hash and radio frequency noise on power cables round the country. Those industries found to be radiating high-frequency noise into the national grid, above certain levels, are required by law to install filters. It's a bit different in other larger countries, though, where it would be totally uneconomic to bury all the power cables to more isolated communities. And those very long lengths of wire, strung up on high-tension pylons, pick up a lot of noise along the way. Televisions and electric drills are obvious sources of radio interference. The line oscillator that helps to make the TV picture works at radio frequencies. And with the elementary screening on the average television, some of that interference leaks out, to be picked up by your radio. The carbon brushes of an electric motor never make perfect contact, leading to small sparks. Once again, a sensitive radio will pick them up right across the shortwave dial. But the growing use of microprocessors in household products is leading to a new breed of unusual interference sources. Bram Bochart of the Radio Control Service's Interference Division has been giving me details.
Everything is microprocessor controlled. Even in your car you may have some microprocessor functions. And all these things can make interference. Of course there is an oscillator in it, which makes a frequency from about 1, 2, 3 or 4 megahertz. And it produces also other frequencies. And everything in your equipment is making a kind of transmitting antenna, so that every equipment in the neighborhood can receive that interferences.
We could play a number of interference examples, but I don't think many of the buzzes and bleeps would make it round the other side of the globe. This one will, though. Do you recognize this problem?
Murder of a policeman this year by the provisional IRA.
Patrolling the streets of Newcastle.
That horrible noise is caused by a simple thermostat, the kind you might find in an electric blanket or in the heater used in an aquarium. A bimetallic strip is used to control the temperature, and when the contacts slightly open, you get sparking across the contacts for just a few moments. Household central heating thermostats often have a mercury switch, which produces a similar noise. One of the most puzzling problems for a while here was why a rechargeable shaver unit should produce the same short burst of interference. It seems the unit had a built-in thermal cutout, and when the small transformer inside the shaver charger got warm, after about 45 minutes, it would keep switching on and off every 10 minutes or so to prevent the transformer overheating. Luckily, though, the incidence of this type of interference is decreasing in this part of Europe.
Also going down are especially light dimmers, because there have come, since a few years, some regulations for that kind of special electronic equipment, and that makes the manufacturers have to make especially something in the unit to decrease the interference, and that means there is no more interference when you buy it.
Fluorescent lights are much quieter in the last few years too, though if you really want to listen to weak shortwave signals, installing a fluorescent tube in the listening room still isn't a good idea. The background noise will definitely go up. In the last couple of years, another type of lamp has come into popular use, called SL lamps. They're designed to replace a traditional light bulb. They're usually somewhat bigger than a traditional tungsten filament bulb, but use much less power for the same light output. Because they involve high-frequency oscillators to make them work, early versions of this type of bulb were rather like a local radio station, broadcasting buzzes and general hash for several blocks. But national interference departments, like this one here in Holland, drew the manufacturer's attention to the problem. But can you still hear the newer versions of these SL bulbs on a sensitive portable radio?
Yes, very short distance, 2 or 3 meters, perhaps 10 or 15 meters, but I found only 1 or 2 cases in 1 year, if that.
And how many complaints do you deal with a year?
Well, the Radio Control Dienst has about 5,000 from these things in a year, and I take about 500 of them.
Is that service free?
Yes, it's service free, yes.
Suppose you buy an expensive shortwave radio, put up an aerial in the garden, and find that the neighbour, a few metres away, has just bought a very noisy television set which ruins your reception. If you're living in Holland, can you simply phone the radio control service and have them pay a visit to your electrically noisy neighbour?
Well, no, not especially. First, we also take a look at the equipment. We look at the antenna. Is there enough signal on your equipment? Because if it isn't, then we go home. But if there is really a great kind of interference, then we go to the person who makes the interference. And then there are some regulations, so we've got to measure the interference to see if there is a level of which we can say, well, that's too much interference. You've got to decrease that.
What's the level of interference? Is there a figure?
You've got to measure that. You do that in dB or dB microfarads. And that's
okay, very technical terms.
Yes, it's very technical. And it's not the same for a television or a transmitter.
For the investigators, interference problems fall into two types.
There are two kinds of things which may be different. You can have interference which is always in the air, but it's a very small signal. So it's very easy to find it when you are very high on a building. But when you're in the street, you can't hear it. So it may take some days to find that. Got an electronic clock. It took us 3 days. But if you have an electric blanket, if you've got spark interferences, which come only 1 or 2 times in a day. And that's very difficult to find.
In most countries, including the Netherlands, there's a limit to what the radio listener can demand. If a neighbour's washing machine or TV is ruining reception of a local radio station, the authorities are often obliged to help. But they're less responsive if you demand perfect electrical silence from the rest of the neighbourhood, while you use a massive long-wire antenna to listen to a 10-watt station in Peru. In the United States, the FCC has laid down interference standards for many electrical goods, especially home computers. In Europe, it's taking longer. Shortwave listener groups have not got involved in the lawmaking process with regard to consumer interference. John Greenwell is actively involved in Britain protecting the interests of amateur radio enthusiasts. After all, with a transmitter in house that may cause patterns on the neighbour's screen, they have more serious social EMC problems than most listeners.
Legislation at the moment is moving very slowly. We have in the UK a number of what we call British standards, which have been drafted that relate to interference over a wide range of subjects, both in equipments of radio and television and computer devices. However, in order to be compatible within Europe, most of these specifications will never be issued, but many of the recommendations will be incorporated into the Senelec standards, which will apply within the EEC in due course.
Now, what about the manufacturers? Do they accept these? Because in some cases, putting extra screening, let's say, into televisions means more investment.
Yes, a very valid point. The British Radio Equipment Manufacturers Association, BREMA, are very keen to establish limits which are universal and both economic. And they are talking of limits of about 2 volts per meter as immunity for the average domestic product. In the Netherlands, I understand 1 volt per meter is the present standard, or at least working level.
Is that the problem, that it's always at a recommendation level at the moment and there's no actual legislation, so that if somebody's got a television set that's wide open like a barn door to all sorts of interference, that you can turn around and say, well, I'm sorry, I can't do anything about my transmitter, it's your old television set?
Well, there's a bit of that, and of course this misunderstanding that develops between the amateur and his neighbour is probably one of our biggest problems. But in addition, the Radio Investigation Service throughout the United Kingdom, we regretfully find, do not apply a universal level to the amateur. In some areas they are very helpful to the amateur, in some areas they will close him down for 28 days while he gets cooperation with his neighbour. However, if the neighbour does not wish to cooperate, it is little that the amateur can do. This is regrettable. I understand in the Netherlands, if the neighbour does not cooperate, then the amateur is allowed to go back on the air.
Interference in the night, 1,000 miles on either side, stations fading into the unknown. And listen to the radio.
More and more shortwave hobbyists are using home computers, often very near the radio. Radio Netherlands Computer Bulletin Board recently dealt with a number of listener queries from people who want to somehow shield their noisy computer from the radio. Move the antenna lead-in wire as far away from the computer as possible and shield it. And then use short shielded leads to things like printers and disk drives. And what about screening the entire computer casing? Well, be careful. Recently, some metal conductive paints have appeared on the market. Spray or brush this paint onto the inside cover of your computer and connect it to earth, maybe via a metal drain pipe, say the instructions. And it works for a while. The problem is that the warmth from the computer's circuits often causes the paint to flake off the plastic case after a few months. It falls onto the printed circuit board, often causing a short circuit, resulting in thousands of dollars worth of hardware damage. If you do decide to try this, be warned from other listeners' advice. Products with electric motors in them should already be fitted with suppressors, usually a high-voltage capacitor. Commercially available ferrite beads can be put over noisy cables to filter out some of the radio interference. Enough from me. Jante Host is joining me now. He is with the Radio Control Service's head office in Groningen, based up in the north of the Netherlands. If current discussions continue to progress, we may soon see consumer products which are less noisy in the radio sense.
Yes, we are working on that. Mainly in European context, there is an action going in the direction of legislation on a European level. When they are made in a directive, we have to incorporate that within 1.5 years in our Dutch legislation. And then manufacturers have to comply with those regulations.
So in other words, if they refuse to comply, then you can stop it being sold in the shops?
Yes. For that reason, in other kind of fields at this moment, we are checking with importers and manufacturers in how far their equipment from the manufacturing side out are complying with the regulations.
This is one of the neighbors from down the street. This racket of this music has been going on all afternoon, and I'm sick and tired of it. If it doesn't stop, I'm calling the police.
If you have interference problems with a neighbour's television, do try a friendly approach first. The bottom line for good radio reception is simply give your antenna some air. A radio in the middle of a concrete block of apartments will usually give disappointing shortwave performance. Now let's turn to the other function of this building, namely monitoring work. Through the window I can see about 20 directional shortwave antennas, mostly rhombics, a listener's dream in fact, plus VHF and UHF antennas on a tower. Now, Mr. Ten Horst, I know you can monitor between 0.15 and 1,000 megahertz, but surely you can't do it all at once.
Of course not. We are scanning the spectrum, and we have schedules in which we are monitoring certain parts per week. We are checking in that period in how far all kind of transmitters which we are identifying in that spectrum are in accordance with the IFL, the International Frequency List, which is given out by the IFRB in Geneva.
So that's the International Frequency Registration Board. But if you get a request from somebody abroad, or maybe somebody living in the Netherlands, an organisation, to check the direction of an interference, can you do that?
Yes. We can find the direction out from here, that's Neder-Oostenberg radio station, and we have another station in Zeeland.
So that's about, what, 150 kilometers from here?
Yes, those both stations we can make cross-bearing, but when the basis of 150 kilometers is too small, we can ask other monitoring stations to give another bearing, so we can correctly identify some kind of interference.
Do you coordinate what you're monitoring with, let's say, what's being monitored in Germany?
Monitoring programs are not coordinated. We have our own programs, but we know from them what they are doing.
How much are you monitoring a day, let's say, that you're examining in detail, identifying each station?
Let's ask that on the monitoring station.
All right.
Media Network with CD music, Dolby noise reduction, ultra-low noise tape, and a few bangs from the ionosphere.
So downstairs we go to a large room full of radio equipment and a team of 14 professional listeners. At the shortwave console, I met Jan Verdaan.
Right, we've come now to the monitoring section. And in front of us, a very expensive-looking receiver that covers 10 kilohertz right the way up to 30 megahertz. What are we listening to in the background?
That's a fax transmitter. It's used for photographs from press agencies.
Right, so that's the way they get their the newspaper pictures, is
yes,
it?
That's correct.
Right, we're listening outside the broadcasting band. What's the frequency?
That's in the low frequency band. It's about 138, 137 kilohertz.
Okay, now let's try something else. That sounds more familiar.
Yes, it's indeed. It's also for press information. It's a press transmitter. This normal Telex code, Bordeaux code.
Now you're monitoring and listening to the bands. Can you actually decode what's going out?
Yes, indeed. We have several equipment for that. And we have an analyzer here saying what's the baud rate and what's code it is. So we can use our equipment to decode it and have it on paper.
Right, so then once you've got the station identification, then you move on.
Yes, that's correct.
So you're not interested in content?
No.
Right, let's go to another example. What's that?
It's a simplex store. It's used by our co-station Scheveningen Radio for traffic with the merchant navy. And that's another example of a transmission system.
What does TOR stand for?
Telex over radio.
So it's a more reliable method, let's say, than the ordinary telex system we were listening to before, the Bordeaux system.
There's a correction system in it. It's a different type.
But just how accurately do transmitters have to be on frequency? Let's take an example like Radio Netherlands on 5955.
It has a tolerance of 8 hertz.
So that means if we're 8 hertz off frequency, then we're making mistakes?
Yes, that's correct.
Obviously, if that happens within the Netherlands, it's quite easy, just a telephone call. Mm-hmm. Supposing, on the other hand, you notice that a foreign transmitter is off frequency, what do you do then?
Nothing. Just in case of interference, and we got complaints from Radio Netherlands or other officials, then we put them on telex and ask them to put them on the right frequency.
What are these oscilloscopes for?
Here we can see what we are hearing. That's new. It's a measuring receiver. When we get here a Lisa Jew figure, right, then is the frequency we see here is the right frequency, the measured frequency. And on this scope we can see what we can hear, and it's put now 1 kilohertz per division, so we can see 10 kilohertz bandwidth.
So in other words, it's like a window on the broadcasting band, let's say.
That's correct.
So these spikes that I can see are the transmitters?
Yeah, it's possible.
Right, what have we dialed up here?
Road transmission from Radio Moscow. And you see here the Lisa Jew figure, so we have here the correct frequency.
13725.
Yes, and on this scope you can see the bandwidth needed by this transmitter, and it's 1 kilohertz per division, so you can see it's about 5 kilohertz bandwidth.
So you can judge obviously how well the transmitter is working. In other words, if it's using up too much space.
That's correct.
We come now to a different part of the monitoring room, which in fact begins at 30 megahertz and goes all the way up to 1 gigahertz. And with me is the head of the monitoring service.
Yes, my name is Van Duyn.
Right, and your first name?
Willem.
Okay, now we're tuned to 67 megahertz, or 67.961 to be precise, and we're listening to the television, is that right?
Yes, we are listening to the television, that's channel 4 from Olympic.
Voor degenen die belangstelling hebben voor het Nederlands studentenkamerakkoord.
Right, that's the obviously the sound channel. What about the vision? Can you also pick that up?
Yes, the vision, that's on the frequency 62.26 megahertz.
So in other words, 5.5 megahertz away.
Yes, that's correct. Now you can hear the picture. At home you see the picture and here you can hear it.
And this is a particularly well-known noise if you listen on the FM bands in the Netherlands. What's that?
That's the so-called semaphone.
So it works rather like this beeper system. You carry a sort of little receiver with you, and when it gets the right code, it makes a noise.
Yes, it makes a noise. It makes an alarm, and then the person knows who he has to dial.
The penultimate guest in today's programme is Andy Sennett, not from the PTT, but from the World Radio TV Handbook, based in Amsterdam. Before we get on to your tuning suggestions, Andy, you've got a pretty unique reception problem at your office near the Rijksmuseum.
Yes, indeed. You see, my office is located immediately next to the Museum Hotel, and while that's very convenient for visitors, I soon discovered a problem. I dutifully rigged up a shortwave antenna, then turned on my receiver, only to be confronted with time-based interference from anything up to 200 television sets at once. So, not much DXing for me during working hours. Well, now to the news, and the Voice of Peace has resumed operating on medium wave from its ship in the Eastern Mediterranean. They're using a newly installed transmitter, and for the past few months they've only been on VHF. The medium wave frequency of the Voice of Peace, as before, is 1530 kHz, 1530. Well, it seems that All India Radio's new external service site at Bangalore is well on the way to completion. We've received a press release from the Marconi Company saying that they've received an order for 27 further antennas for Phase 2 of the construction project, having successfully delivered 9 for the first phase. This will be a 500 kilowatt facility, but at the moment I don't have any information about the target date for the start of on-air testing. And it's not often that we manage to get hold of a current printed schedule for All India Radio, but we have managed to get one for both the external and domestic services. Some handwritten changes have been made on our copy for the East Regional Shortwave Service from Guwahati. For the Guwahati A programme, the printed frequency of 5970 kHz has been deleted and replaced by 4940, and watch out because that's one of the frequencies used by the Marshall Islands. That's on at 02 to 0400 UTC. And 5970 is also replaced by 7280 between 0630 and 0900 UTC. Finally, the Guwahati B program also has a handwritten change, with 7150 kHz being replaced by 6130 in the period from 0630 to 1015 UTC, and that schedule should remain valid until September the 6th. Well, it seems that plans for NDXE, the stereo station in the United States, are still going ahead. The latest news we have is a press release telling us that a feature about NDXE will appear in the July edition of Omni magazine. That's an American science magazine. And the press release also says that the station will begin service next year on the shortwave bands in stereo. I seem to have heard that somewhere before.
So have I, Andy. And I understand that NDXE is still waiting for the local power company in Opelika, Alabama, to offer them enough power for what they claim they're planning to build. The delays, though, aren't doing much to the station's credibility. Well, Andy, you, I believe, have got details of a programme that's due to air in, what, a matter of hours, and nothing should stop that one.
Yes, indeed, tomorrow, in the special English service of the Voice of America, there's going to be a feature about the world's first commercial radio station, which started broadcasting from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on November the 2nd, 1920. And the feature will tell the history of that radio station, which the VOA says is in many ways the history of radio in the United States.
Sounds interesting. Andy, I've had quite a few comments from listeners this past week wondering if the World Radio TV Handbook is going to restart their computer bulletin board shortly. Well, I know that's not the case for a little while yet, but can you accept changes from listeners on floppy disk? That's a question I noticed on a postcard that I picked up this morning.
Yes, we are now in a position to accept information on floppy disk. And if you have a 5¼-inch floppy disk and can work on the MS-DOS system, then we'd be very interested to get your news on floppies. And eventually we'll have a modem so that you can actually download information to us over the telephone. But at the moment, I'm afraid you'll have to use the regular mail. And if you do send a floppy to P.O. Box 50558 in Amsterdam, please also ensure that it's well packed, because they can get damaged in the mail. That's P.O. Box 50558, Amsterdam.
I'm off to catch a plane to Toronto, Canada now for the Association of North American Radio Clubs meeting, which officially starts in a few hours' time. Who knows what'll happen? I don't, but you will if you join us in 7 days. Bye now. Hey, wait a minute, that's a helicopter effect. The script here says a plane.
Oh, sorry.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.